And it wasn't even me this time. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 322.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 322 would extend the multiple unit housing tax exemption to the value of any design or public benefit elements required by the city or county as part of multiple unit housing construction. This would include commercial spaces. The measure also extends the sunset for the multiple unit exemption from January 1st, 2012 to January 1st, 2022. It has some wording changes to it to modernize wording, but doesn't change the meaning. And the measure adds the explicit provision that commercial property rate may also receive the property tax exemption. Senate Bill 1015, passed in the 2010 session, extended the property tax exemption for this multiple unit housing to the commercial portion of multiple unit housing that had exemptions prior to August 26, 2009. And Senate Bill 322 follows up with that intent and exempts those required commercial properties that are approved after August 26, 2009. There is a fiscal impact statement of a minimal expenditure impact, and the revenue impacts would be small in the next two biennia. It would be some small portion of the $6.6 million that's spent on this exemption as a whole. If it were for some reason not extended for the sunset.
All right. Thank you. Katie Allen, Nancy Bennett, Jill Sherman. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Bennett with Multnomah County, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning in support of Senate Bill 322. I'm pleased to be joined today by Kate Allen, our colleague from the City of Portland, Jill Sherman with Girding Eldon Development, who is a member of the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission, Janet Bird representing the Housing Alliance, and Denny Broad with the City of Eugene. As we just heard a moment ago, Senate Bill 322 extends the sunset date of the Multiple Unit Housing Exemption Program to 2022 and includes language that clarifies that the commercial portion of the housing structure can be exempt so long as it provides a clear public benefit as specified by the city or county. We're here this morning to ask you to extend this exemption program. In short, it works and provides local leaders with an important strategic public investment tool to advance housing and community goals. In a moment, you'll hear more details about how the program works and who is served, but first I'd like to take this opportunity to highlight some of the coordinated work that is underway between the City of Portland and Multnomah County to strengthen and enhance this property tax exemption program. As I mentioned a moment ago, this program is an important development tool, but in this era of scarce public dollars, we must balance development goals with revenue impacts, and that's especially important to the county. So toward this end, Multnomah County Chair Jeff Kogan and City Commissioner Nick Fish are co-chairs of what we call the Big Look Policy Committee. There's a dynamic group of community members, including schools, all the local governments, elected leaders, private sector banks, and so on, who have come together to evaluate the current goals and effectiveness of the residential property tax abatement programs in order to guide their future direction. And we have Jill here today who's going to talk a little more about that. And the outcome of this work, which has been underway for a number of months now and will be finishing up this summer, is to guide us in making program changes that, again, can really sort of balance these housing goals and the stewardship of property tax revenue. The extension of this exemption, this multiple unit housing exemption, will enable our county and city partners to continue to refine and develop this work and create a program at the local level that we feel reflects the needs of our community.
Thanks. Good morning, co-chairs Barnhart and Berger and the committee. My name is Kate Allen. I serve as the housing policy manager for the City of Portland Housing Bureau under the leadership of Portland City Commissioner Nick Fish. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 322 as amended. Commissioner Fish regrets that a previously scheduled meeting in Portland with HUD Deputy Secretary Ron Sims keeps him from being here with you this morning, but he sends his greetings. As you know, Commissioner Fish oversees the Portland Housing Bureau's administration of the limited tax exemption programs and is pleased to co-chair with his colleague, Chair Multnomah County Chair Kogan, the review committee that Nancy referred to. As you are aware, Senate Bill 322 extends the sunset date of the multiple unit housing exemption. The bill also completes the administrative cleanup of the statute by establishing the authority of local governments to design and implement programs that strategically meet local housing and community development goals. The exemption program provides a strategic, limited-term investment by local governments, and it leverages private equity and conventional debt. At a time of declining public resources, it's an important tool in our toolkit to address the unmet housing needs of the citizens. The new multiple unit housing and transit-oriented development programs that Portland operates under the statutory authority of ORS 307-600 through 637 relating to multiple unit housing provide an incentive for the construction of new, higher density, mixed income housing near transit facilities such as the MAX light rail system and in designated centers and corridors. Does this by exempting the taxes on the value of the improvement for the period of the exemption. The underlying land remains taxable. In 2010-11, the new multi-unit and TOD exemption programs benefit a total of 3,100 units citywide in Portland and represent an investment by all taxing jurisdictions, that is foregone revenue, of about $3,900,000. The current authority sunsets in 2012, and extension of the multi-unit housing exemption for 10 years signals to the finance and development community that the jurisdictions are supportive of certain types of higher density, transit-proximate, mixed-income housing to increase housing opportunities in locations consistent with our development goals. I mentioned that there are about 3,000 units served with these programs. Those are probably about 30 buildings in the metro, across the metro area, certainly in the downtown, but in a number of other transit locations. You'll hear a little later from our colleague in Eugene. The program has also been used in East Multnomah County, City of Gresham, and is under consideration, this and other programs, in other parts of the metropolitan Portland region. The units in those 3,000 represent about 2,900 units of rental housing and 160 owned units. Of those, about 1,200 are affordable to residents with whose incomes are less than 60% of the median family income. For a family of four, that would be about $42,000 a year in the metro area. Another 109 are restricted at 80% of median family income, and the remainder of the units are unrestricted. Commercial improvements in those in a number of those buildings include neighborhood-serving businesses such as child care, pharmacies, cafe, coffee shop, grocery, and local retail. In these locations, local zoning requires ground floor commercial uses. In Portland's Northeast Hollywood District, the Bookmark Apartments development is a good example. This 2002 development includes 47 apartments, 19 of those 47 are affordable at that 60% of median family income. Those apartments are over ground floor commercial uses that include the Hollywood branch of the public library and a coffee shop. The affordable apartments there allow lower-income residents, including seniors, to remain in this comfortable, walkable neighborhood with access to amenities such as grocery, high-frequency bus service, and good connections to the medical services and others that they need. The City of Portland takes seriously its administrative duties with regard to the programs. We adopt ordinances authorizing the use of the statutory authority to advance local planning, development, and housing goals.
Excuse me, I noticed that you're on page 3 of your prepared remarks. If you could summarize the rest of it, that would be very helpful.
I'd be very happy to.
Thank you. Generally speaking, and I'll say this to everyone else too, if you have written materials that you've given us, we'll have those, and summarizing means that our time will be utilized well, and members, of course, will have a chance to review the written material later if they so choose.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bonhart. I'll do so. Wanted to touch briefly on a stringent administrative process that has several steps of review, importantly, a review against community development goals that are held in our planning documents, and a review of the financial performance of the project, which looks to assure that a developer does not is not overly enriched. That is, the development has to pass a test that limits the return on the developer's investment to less than 10%. This is also a test that's monitored on an annual basis, and under a regulatory agreement, the developer there is a clawback provision. That is, if the development performs beyond that point, there is the ability of the local government to reclaim that tax revenue. I wanted to touch on the fact that the exemption, importantly, leverages private investment, and leverages also the development of public benefits in places where we want them. We see this, as I mentioned, as an important tool, especially as public resources decline to accomplish these goals, to leverage private investment, and would want to emphasize specifically that accomplishing commercial space, those public serving or neighborhood serving commercial improvements, is an important component, but very much part of the purview of the collaborative review process, to be sure, especially with our partners at the county and at the schools, that the benefit is, the public benefit is rich enough to warrant the investment of the public, warrant the investment of this public dollar. So in conclusion, please consider carefully the balanced approach being taken by local governments and with the private sector, and allow us to use this tool, which has created well-located, mixed-income, and mixed-use developments, to preserve and enhance our ability to leverage investments in transportation and other urban infrastructure and achieve local housing and development goals. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs Barnhart and Berger and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning in support of Senate Bill 322. My name is Jill Sherman. I'm a vice president of development with Girding Yeadlin, a real estate development company headquartered in Portland. And I'm also a private sector member of the Big Look Review Committee. Developers are partners with the public sector in this effort to achieve goals for development of mixed-income housing that leverages local investment in transit and other infrastructure and creates vibrant neighborhoods where commercial services such as grocery stores, daycare, medical offices, and other neighborhood-serving amenities are present. The program makes it feasible for developers to build in these areas that are often higher cost, as well as to include public benefit elements in the projects, whether that be some space in the building that's available to the community or providing a higher level of green building or sustainability as part of the project. I can tell you from my experience in running, you know, multiple pro formas for multiple developments, this tool can in fact be the one that takes a particular project from something that is not feasible to something that is feasible. So it can in fact be the difference between getting this kind of mixed income, more dense, well-located project actually completed. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be just a an indication of my ignorance on the topic, but I'm curious if you could talk a bit more about what public benefit element means. If that's a definition that everyone but me understands, that's fine, but I'd appreciate some help.
I can take that. When the programs were developed in the probably mid-90s, certainly have been in use in Portland longer than that. The notion that we wanted to spur residential development in these places included the notion that most zoning included ground floor commercial. The public benefit is a way to describe things that are positive types of development. So for each of the programs in the city code and in the application process, there are a set number of things that a developer would have to do in addition to the location efficiency and a certain baseline of affordability within those. So similar to the way Jill has described them, those are often neighborhood-serving retail. They are a higher level of affordability, so a buyer, a developer could increase the number of affordable units. They are building in community space that is available for local community meetings. Another good example is inclusion of childcare as a commercial. The other has been recently location of a car share spot on site. It's those kinds of things that would be considered a public benefit. Right now, as part of the Big Look process, the city and the county are refining and tightening, frankly, that list of public benefits. Just being a quarter mile from the transit is no longer enough where we have a much more built-out transit system. So we would look for some greater level of rigor and public benefit for the investment of the tax dollar.
I have a brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So that's very helpful, and I appreciate it. Is there any, in your Big Look conversation about tightening, is there any distinction about different sorts of retail? I can imagine arguments on both sides of that question.
We certainly have the list of things that we would agree would never be a public-serving commercial use. I hope I don't offend anyone by saying we're in agreement with our colleagues at the county that it's likely a liquor store would not be, considered. I think we are working through our process to assure that there is an agreed list of benefits that are rich enough and commonly accessible or needed that the developer, frankly, may demonstrate the need for, child care at that site or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions trying to figure out exactly this, and I'm open on this. I'm not leaning one way or another at this point. If I understand correctly, that the multi-unit housing exemption applies both to low-income housing units but also to multi-unit housing by public transportation, transit districts. Is that correct?
That's correct. It applies to residential development that includes, by the city of Portland's definition, some level of affordability. But it is purposely mixed income and mixed use developments that the exemption incents. So it is not 100% affordable. There are other programs that do that, but we do. In the city, advance our goals for inclusion of affordable housing based on a developer's ability to package this as part of a development.
Okay. Yes, please.
Thank you. In the bill, it talks about that it doesn't have to qualify for public benefit. It applies to commercial property to the extent that the commercial property is a required design or public benefit element. So can you speak to those purposes where it's not a public benefit as much as it's part of the mixed-use zoning that is part of, and not just unique to Portland, but maybe someone else, not unique to Portland or Multnomah County, but to any area in Oregon because this bill is applied across the state. The public, what does the community get in exchange for subsidizing the commercial element of the mixed-use property?
I would say first and foremost, the bill puts in the hands of the local governments the list making on that. So it provides control at the local level to designate what those allowed public benefits will be. And Nancy referred to the process that is collaborative right now amongst City of Portland, Multnomah County, and includes our impacted school districts to reach a list. So I think whether it is City of Portland or City of Gresham or City of Eugene, this bill pushes to the local level the decision-making. That's the May part. Is that
And I would just add that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the city of Portland will have to, you know, enact an ordinance that sort of puts this, you know, details these points out, and then the county has to pass a resolution in support of that. So there are quite a few steps and some public process, I think, that also we go through. It's not as though just people sit in a back room and make a list and that's how it works. It's much more public than that.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you. If I might follow up, getting away from the public benefit language, because it doesn't just require that, it also requires required design, putting on my Planning Commission hat, basically what you're getting at there, what I read the language to be, is as we go through on these different uses, either outright permitted or conditional uses, and then through the local, if I understand correctly, then at the county or city, at that point in these different areas within your jurisdiction, that's where you would choose the outright permitted or conditional use, commercial uses of those properties. And that's where the decision would be made of whether or not it is worthy of being subsidized by an exemption from property taxes.
That's correct.
Thank you. I am done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Pardon my voice. I have a little bit of experience with multi-family, low-income housing, multi-use. It's prevalent in my district and has been for about 25 years now. And we were one of the first to move forward with the transportation housing changes along the east side max line. I don't know what color that is because I just call it the east side max line. But I take it one of the goals that we're trying to accomplish with this tax credit is to incent affordable housing in places where it wouldn't otherwise crop up in the marketplace. Am I correct in that assumption?
The city of Portland has, for the way our city operates these programs, has included as one of the required public benefits inclusion of affordable housing. The bill itself is specific to a level of affordability that would be as part of these. I think in the city we have put additional requirements for that. So there is, you're right, some a level of affordability included in the developments that are supported by this exemption.
Okay. Can I follow up? And understanding that anything that we use a tax credit for, it incents, it distorts the marketplace, if you will, for particular policy goals and particular policy aims. And that's necessary and proper, and that's the way that we operate here. So what I'd like to see out of this kind of a bill, and I don't want to throw this out there and get your comment, what I see as the biggest problem with affordable housing is that the marketplace clusters affordable housing next to affordable housing. And we've certainly seen that in the Rockwood area. Mm-hmm. And if you are a young person growing up in a difficult situation with a lower socioeconomic class, if you are surrounded by people that are exactly the same as you, then the cycle of poverty becomes much more difficult to break out of. But if you are in a cluster of folks in, say, Lincoln High School area or at Lake Oswego, and you are the only person that is growing up in that socioeconomic class, but all your buddies are more well-to-do and have a lot of support, then it's far easier to break the cycle of poverty. So what I'd like your comment on is, my thought process surrounding this is that if we're truly going to leverage our credit for the common good to help break the cycle of poverty, what we ought to do is have a requirement in any tax credit like this that can only be used in areas that are well-to-do, in areas that have a higher median income, so that we can use it as a way of creating stronger communities and breaking the cycle of poverty. And I'd just like to know what your comments are, if that's on the right track or something you could get behind.
So there's a couple things I would say. One is that that issue has been explicitly discussed at this committee, that particularly in the single, I guess we're not talking about single family here, are we? Okay, never mind, I won't go into that. But to make sure that you're not ending up with additional affordable housing in areas that already have a lot of affordable housing, and maybe areas that don't have other types of infrastructure that they need, transit, sidewalks, et cetera, or school districts that can take on the additional children that might have additional needs, as not being sort of a goal of the tax exemption. And so when a developer goes to use it, we're looking first at, for us, we really like these transit-rich locations anyway, because we think, that they have a market advantage in the long term. And so we're looking at them. We're looking at the tax exemption to make a project feasible. And then we're also required by the city, therefore, to include affordable housing. So it's mixed income. It's not all affordable. So it's some percentage of the units being affordable. And it tends to be in a location because, again, we've looked at it as a market rate project, and so that's the location that we've chosen. And then as part of what we're required, the quid pro quo, if you will, for getting the exemption, we're including affordable units as part of that project. So I would say that it does end up in many cases addressing what you're asking.
Can I take a stab at this, Co-Chair and Representative Juan? I think this is something that the county is recognizing more and more. I think you make a really good point. And I know that some of our internal discussion around adding this commercial piece is sort of, explicitly clarifying that in this bill. There was some initial resistance around that. But I think when we really looked at an opportunity to create more vibrant neighborhoods, to create amenities, and to kind of not just add a bunch of low-income housing in clustered together, as you say, but if you add in a grocery store or some of these other pieces, it does create a healthier neighborhood. And I think there is a more holistic view of that that's emerging at the county, because we're just, tend to look at the tax dollars and not want to see those go away. But I think that's why we're so supportive of this bill and so supportive of this project and these programs. So you make a great point, though, and I think it's on our radar, too.
Thank you. Other questions? I have a couple. This bill appears to add, on page 2, line 22, this discussion about commercial property, commercial property is included in these multi-unit housing constructions. The way the bill's drafted, that appears to be an add-on. How are you doing the kinds of commercial properties as part of these kinds of buildings now?
So a little bit of history, and even recent history, as recent as the 2010 legislature. The city of Portland and the county have been operating these programs under a certain interpretation of the statute as it stood.
Mm-hmm.
That interpretation was called into question a review by the Department of Revenue and the Attorney General's office resulted in a letter that raised the question about whether the commercial use was specifically allowed under the statute as it stood. We came to the 2010 legislature to ask for a grandfather of the properties that had received that commercial exemption, had essentially played by the rules. That grandfather provision was adopted. The city and county then continued the work to figure out what's the right way to approach that. We sought and received good counsel from the Department of Revenue, so the specific inclusion of that language was a result of both our process and the DOR.
Thank you. I think I'm remembering that conversation.
It's a long time.
And, of course, the justification for the bill in February was that you had been operating under an understanding of the statute.
That's correct.
That people had changed their positions financially and in terms of planning and construction under that interpretation, and that it was only fair that the legislature should say, okay, all that you've already done is fine, but we're not necessarily approving anything new. I think that's essentially what that bill did.
That's exact recollection.
Right.
Yes, sir.
The other question I had, it relates to the sunset. We're moving a sunset for 10 years. Could you give us a sense what the cycle is on on this kind of planning and construction. I note that there are really two sunsets. One of them says in the case of conversion that you have to have an application in by the sunset date. And the other one, in the case of new construction, says that you have to have it completed by the sunset date. Could you give us an idea what kind of planning and construction cycle time we're talking about for a project of the sort that would contemplate using this statute?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of variability, of course, in how long a real estate development project can take. But for the type of multifamily, I'm thinking 100 units, maybe 150 units with ground floor retail, you're probably looking at 8 months or so to design it and maybe 14 to 16 months to build it. So from when you first identify a site and, you know, decide you have a project that's feasible, you probably have a couple of years until the project is actually operating.
Okay.
I'd say additionally, part of what we are signaling, especially to the finance community right now, who is looking for stability around the development process and their ability to finance, is the extending the sunset for the period of 10 years and doing it now ahead of the expiration signals that as our economy recovers and as we begin to build again, we're signaling to the finance community that we are very much interested in the participation of the private sector developers and financiers in advancing the local goals for development and inclusion of housing.
Are there projects that are in the preliminary planning stage or that were postponed as a result of the recession that would pick up fairly quickly as the economy improves if a statute like this were passed?
Yes, sir, there are.
I would agree. I would say that there could be projects, in fact, that haven't been able to go forward, but as the economy picks up and if they had this program to use as a tool, could move forward more quickly or, again, make the difference between moving forward or not, because really this tool can be that difference mm-hmm. for a certain type of project.
Okay.
I update quite regularly a pipeline of potential projects that would potentially qualify for this kind of an exemption. I also reached out yesterday to our colleagues both in the city of Hillsborough and at the city of Gresham in the respective urban renewal activity areas, and just sort of to get a read of what the activity level is. You'll also hear good testimony from our colleague at the city of Eugene
right.
about the, you know, what we're beginning to see the seeds of.
And I'm anxious to get onto that, but I have another question, and I think Representative Bentz at least has some as well. Let me sort of finish this line of thinking. From our point of view, I think it's fair to say that this, while we grandfathered in the projects that were already underway before that date in 2009, that the commercial property extension issue is a significant one for us, and I'm trying to figure out how long an extension you actually have to have in order for the legislature to get a second look soon to figure out whether it wants to go ahead with this kind of a program or not. The reason I'm asking the question is because the material on page 2, lines 22 to 24, gives an enormous amount of planning authority through this mechanism to local governments. And the question, I think, would be, is the local government using that wisely and appropriately? I'm thinking that 10 years is a fairly long time because you wouldn't be back here for another extension until 20 or maybe 19, given the cycle that you're working from. Could you manage this program if this Sunset were a lot shorter, and if so, how short can we make it and still allow you a cycle or two to be able to demonstrate the operation of that new language?
I don't know. you development expert should probably answer that question.
I think you have captured what the local governments who are represented here today and others are after, which is a level of collaborative program design at the local level. Mm-hmm. We know that our colleagues in some of the cities across the state would not use this.
Right. My specific question is, how short can we make the sunset and still allow it to be useful for you in the near term? Allow this mechanism to be useful in the near term. And that may be difficult to answer right this minute, but I'd sure like an answer in the next few days.
Let's follow up. We'll thank you.
Thank you
for
very
the
much.
Opportunity
Representative,
to follow up
Representative
on that.
Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always interested, particularly in our review of all of our tax credits, in the value we're receiving for the credit given, and putting some specific numbers on it. It appears from our revenue impact statement that the cost of this is $6.6 million per biennium, and the 10-year extension would be 10 times that. And I'm interested in knowing how many folks have been benefited by this when it comes to just the low-income housing people. I'd kind of like to know per person how that money is measured. Do you know how many folks have been benefited by this?
What you're asking, I think, we have in my testimony for the two programs that the City of Portland uses under this statutory authority, the new multi-unit and the TOD, there are approximately 3,000 units currently benefiting from the exemption. What you would be after would be, of those, how many are affordable, so within that description, and that's about 1,200 that is the City of Portland's affordability description that's in our code. 1,200 of those units affordable at 60% of median or less. Historically, there are a number of projects that have enjoyed the exemption and have come off of the program. So that would add to that number. So I think I could construct the answer. I don't have it off the top of my head. I would refer to the 2009-10 report that the City of Portland produces annually on the exemption programs, all five of them that are used, and I would go back and dig into that research a little bit. You've got the document.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I didn't see it. A follow-up.
Please, yeah.
Thank you. I didn't see it in the report, but it doesn't mean it's not there. But I would like to very much see the per-person number so I can see how the $6 million breaks out, or however much Portland is using is the better way to put it, because I don't think you're using the entire six. Eugene's using part of it and so forth.
Right. So for our programs, it's roughly $3.9 million for these programs. And so the math that you're asking for is of those 1,200 that are affordable, what is the division on what part of the 3.9 million annual exemption is applied to those units?
Right.
And I wish my head math were quick enough to do that. I will get that back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that would be something that the entire committee would like to see.
Absolutely.
And I also the answer to my question.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Chair, could I add more to that, please?
Yes, please. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to disrupt the flow, but...
No, it's fine.
I've been thinking more about the definition of public benefit. Representative Abreu and I were conferring a bit on that as well. And so in the context of the things you're putting together for the benefit of the committee, I'd like to add to that some more description of how you will decide that. With the grocery store example seems like a good one, but as you're thinking about the authority we'd be delegating, I'd like to learn more about how you intend to decide what is and isn't public benefit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And that does really go along with the issue that I was raising, and I think that's very appropriate. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. Let's hear from Eugene, Denny Rod, Janet Bird, and then also Sherry. Last name starts with a W. Yes, sir.
Good morning, co-chairs Berger, Barnhart, and members of the committee. My name is Denny Burrow. I'm a senior development analyst in the City of Eugene's Planning and Development Department. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 322. The multi-unit property tax exemption is a strategic tool that we are currently using to implement the city's growth management policies, basically, by targeting new multi-unit housing in well-defined areas, core areas of our city. And I just want to address quickly Representative Wan's question about affordability. In Eugene, this hasn't traditionally been a program that we've used for affordable housing projects. Most of the affordable housing projects in Eugene use a low-income housing tax exemption, which is actually a 20-year tax exemption program. Our program really is focused on downtown core area, smart growth, dense housing, trying to accomplish some of our smart growth policies. And in Eugene, developing in the core is very challenging because the economics of compact urban growth are difficult to overcome, particularly when trying to steer dense housing into the central core area of our city. Despite the fact that there's very strong demand for housing in our downtown core area, there are offsetting barriers that must be overcome before this desirable form of housing development can be realized. And these barriers include higher land costs downtown, aging infrastructure, environmental cost, additional costs associated with providing embedded and underground parking, higher construction costs downtown related to building multiple stories, and mixing commercial and residential uses also add costs for these desirable mixed-use projects. The multi-unit property tax exemption is the primary tool that we use to level the playing field, so that we at least have a chance to attract housing investments into the targeted areas where barriers exist and more density is desired. Similar to Portland's efforts that were referenced in their testimony, Eugene has also been working hard to be good stewards of this tax exemption program. In 2008, our Eugene City Council adopted public benefit criteria that are used in the project approval process. In addition to demonstrating a financial need for the tax exemption, which is reviewed by a committee of financial professionals, projects must also respond to criteria which includes green building features, density, mixed income, accessibility, location, quality building materials, preservation of historical resources, and neighborhood impacts. Eugene is also currently undergoing a comprehensive Envision Eugene community-wide planning effort that will guide how the city grows over the next 20 years. All things being equal, multifamily housing is not likely to occur in the city center. Therefore, the multi-unit property tax exemption program is expected to be one of the major tools that we will use to influence how our city grows over the next several years. And the proposed extension of the program's sunset date to 2022 is critical for us to preserve the opportunity to use this tool to shape future growth. And as a follow-up to Co-Chair Barnhart's question regarding the 2022 date, the 10-year period, in Eugene, in the downtown core area, we may actually be looking at one project per year, if we're lucky, in this program. You know, a 10-year window of opportunity to really make an impact to bring some density downtown would be important for us. Also, as we're looking at this 20-year Envision Eugene process, having that tool available for some time period to use to, again, really make an impact on how the city grows over the next 10 and 20 years, I think also would be important. In addition to Eugene's support for the extended sunset date, the proposed for clarification regarding the local strategic inclusion of commercial uses and the definition of public benefit is also supported because this provides an added opportunity to encourage limited commercial activity that may not occur otherwise in targeted locations. And in Eugene, we have not historically granted exemptions on the commercial portions of this project, so this would be a new concept for us. Finally, at a time when public resources are declining, it makes sense to pause and look at the costs and benefits of offering the multi-unit property tax exemption. After the passage of ballot measure 47, property tax limitation in 1996, Eugene placed a moratorium on its multi-unit property tax exemption program with the hopes that we might capture some new revenue in the absence of the tax exemption. So for 5 years, we did not accept any applications in the program. During those 5 years, there were no new major multi-unit housing projects built within the boundary. So we concluded that there's clear cause and effect, that there is that this desirable form of development would not likely occur in the absence of the tax exemption, and that there is very little actual cost associated with the use of this tool. In fact, today, many of these previously exempt properties are now coming onto the tax rolls and actively generating new tax revenue for the community. Eugene currently has multiple projects in the queue, two of which are located in the downtown core. I can say with confidence that they have little or no chance of moving forward without the tax exemption. That's just the reality of the economics of downtown Eugene. In order to see these and other projects become a reality and to preserve the opportunity to replicate the success we've had using this program in the past, the City of Eugene strongly supports Senate Bill 322. Again, thank you for the opportunity to have our position on the record, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I am the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships. I serve as the chair of the Housing Alliance, which is a statewide coalition of local jurisdictions, nonprofit organizations, and other organizations that are concerned about housing needs in our communities. I appreciate your time today. I won't read you my testimony. I just want to say a couple things. We know that there is significant need for affordable housing, particularly affordable rental housing, all across the state of Oregon. The Housing Alliance, I've submitted at different times to the committee, county by county need sheets. I'd be happy to provide those to any of you. There have also been a couple reports issued in the last 3 weeks that look at the disparities between what people can afford and what's available in the rental market. We also know that that rental vacancy rates are very low, so there's a lot of demand for rental housing. So I just want to emphasize that we know that there's a need for these kinds of strategies. And the Housing Alliance really believes that we need a range of tools and approaches, and so we strongly support this particular tool to create incentives for affordable housing development. We also track fairly closely the conversations going on in the city of Portland and Multnomah County about the need for certain kinds of commercial activities. There was just a report in the Oregonian this past weekend about food deserts in the city of Portland, and Chair Kogan spoke very persuasively about that when the bill came up on the Senate side. I also just want to emphasize that the exemption is subject to local choice. You've heard from two jurisdictions that look carefully at what the public benefits are that they're aiming for with this exemption. I think particularly in this time of scarce resources, jurisdictions are weighing those choices and priorities really carefully. So I appreciate the questions about what that all means and how that all happens, but we feel confident that that does indeed happen at the local level. We also really believe that this sort of exemption allows jurisdictions to have some creativity and opportunity to look at what kind of communities they want to create and layer that in with other kinds of planning processes. So with that, I'll close. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning.
Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger. My name is Cherie Wargren, Downtown Revitalization Manager for the City of Salem. And I would say that we're very supportive of your continued support of this tax exemption program. The City of Salem has a multi-unit tax exemption program that's been in place since 1978. And I think the difference between the speakers that you've had this morning and Salem is that we have less than 100 rental units in our downtown core. We have been trying for many years to incent through financial incentives that we have the development and redevelopment of our buildings to get more housing in the downtown. We know that in order to be economically viable, we need 24/7 activity, and we have now some opportunity sites that have become available in our downtown core and with the Boise redevelopment site. So we very much would like to encourage support and continuation of this program so we can have it as a tool to help get housing in our downtown core. As others have said, there are very limited financial incentives to encourage mixed-use development, and this program for us would be one that would help us make projects happen. I am going to be very, very brief because I know you have a lot of speakers this morning, but I'd be available to answer questions too.
Thank you. And I think there are some. Yes, Representative Wan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just one one brief question, sir. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Denny Breaux.
Mr. Breaux. So, follow-up.
That's true.
Because that was a question.
Yes.
So, in your testimony, you said that for a while your city stopped all new applicants for this program, and that during the time period that there were no new applicants allowed, there was none of this housing that was built. And that was a problem because you described this as desirable housing and desirable types of projects. And my question to you, sir, is if it's desirable, first question is desirable to whom? And second question is if it's desirable to residents, wouldn't it be profitable and we wouldn't need the tax credit in the first place?
Chairs Berger and Barnhart, Representative Wan, I think that's an excellent question, and it really comes down to economics. And in Eugene, it costs probably as much to build a multi-mixed-use housing project that it would, say, in Seattle. The cost of construction is relatively the same. The problem is the rents are not there to support the construction costs. So, you know, the rents are probably double in a large metro area than what you would experience in Eugene. Without the rents, the project doesn't cash flow, the owner isn't able to obtain the return he's looking for, and ultimately, the bank won't finance it. Our experience is, even with the MUPD tax exemption, even with the city willing to do some subordinate financing, these projects have been very challenging, so much that even with a 0% vacancy rate and a waiting list for downtown housing units, it's not getting built because the economics just don't work in our metro, in our area.
What quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I appreciate your response. I agree with you that economics play a key role. And I think that this tax credit and this bill starts to scratch the surface at an issue that I have been very concerned about for quite a long time, which is to what extent do our land use policies create an environment where people can't afford to live, where our housing costs go up, where we have urban sprawl because of the problems that our land use policies have created in housing? And to what extent do we then have to in response to those problems created by land use, go in and create tax credits that cost yet more money from other folks to try and solve for the problems that we've created on the front end? And I don't know the answers to those questions, because I'm no economist, I'm just a country lawyer, but someday I'd like to figure that out and try and find out how we are creating these problems for ourselves that now we're trying to solve with tax credits, when really we could just go back and fix the policy in the first place and let people live the way that they want to live. That wasn't a question, but thank you for your indulgence.
I appreciate the rhetorical flourish. Despite your cold today, that's wonderful. Thank you. Other questions? I have one set of questions that I think Mr. Breaux, you commented that the City of Eugene doesn't typically allow a tax break on the commercial portion of the buildings that have used this kind of financing. Did I understand that correctly?
Co-Chair Barnhart, yes, that is correct. We have never actually in the history of the program exempted the commercial portion. We have some interest in doing that, particularly, again, in the downtown core where also the retail environment is such that it's very challenging. It's expensive to build that retail space. It's more expensive for the tenants to be in that space. And there are some, the grocery store is a great example. Having services where grocery stores and financial services and things that people can walk to and they don't have to get out of their in their car and drive to the bank or the grocery store would be very desirable in certain circumstances. So I think the council would have some interest in reviewing that on a project-by-project basis, not making it an automatic benefit. It would only be it would be highly scrutinized before we would ever grant that exemption. And because we've never done it before, we'll have to develop some criteria and such.
Thank you. So it's your view that even without the lines that I keep referring to on page 2, 28 lines 22 to 24, even without that, it is possible to build a multi-use building, part of which is tax exempt under the statute, more or less as it exists now, and the other portion of which, the commercial portion of which, is not.
Co-Chair Barnhart, yes.
I understand the answer you just gave to the other question. You don't need to repeat that. But you have been using this statute.
That is correct.
In the way you described earlier.
That is correct.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I'm not sure who to direct this to, staff or one of the lawyers on here. That brings up a thought I had earlier. By adding the commercial part of the exemption, does that then force all cities and counties in the state to require this exemption be applicable to commercial properties? Or is it still is it subjective as to the desires or pleasure of the city or county?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Erbrewer, I believe that the local government still has discretion as to which sorts of public benefit elements might be required as a result of this. I think there are other uses that could be required. I believe parking might be one of them, and public parks or spaces, artwork, meeting rooms, other facilities. And I don't think this would compel the public or the local government to require commercial spaces necessarily, but this definitely, if that commercial space is required, would clarify that it did receive the exemption.
Please.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow up. Again, excluding the public benefit, because there's a big or, is a required design or public benefit element. If we have mixed-use property, and that's where transit property tends to be going, the multi-unit housing that's developing along the rails and such, mixed use tends to be part of it. So if mixed use is part of it, that would be a required design, typically. Then that does in that particular case where a community desires to have mixed use along public transportation, does that then, in that case, because we're, again, it's the or public benefit element we can remove at this point, does that then require them to exempt this if they're exempting the multi-unit housing element of it?
I'd refer you to line 19, where it says the exemption may include. I would read that as saying that it would be up to the local governments to determine what specific elements would be in there. They can, the way the law is written now, they can include parking and a variety of other things in addition to housing.
And not required currently.
But they're not required to.
Okay.
That's right. But they may include parking as a part of multi-unit housing construction. I think that may be the only exception in this statute.
Excellent.
The way it's written right now. Do you have a different hit on that than I do?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
You.
Marcia Kelly, is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill today? I guess you get the stand to yourself, Marcia.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. We have no problem with extending the multi-unit property tax exemption. We do have a problem with extending it to commercial spaces, and I think that if I remember this bill correctly, I believe that of the 160 owned units, they also were exempted from the property tax, and it's an equity issue. You have a business that's in a building that is property tax exempt, potentially competing against a business in another building where they have to pay property taxes. Likewise, you potentially have people who are living in an owned unit and they are not paying property taxes. And someone else in another building that didn't use this multi-unit exemption, and they pay property taxes if they own their unit. So it's a matter of equity. We don't think that the multi-unit exemption is a bad idea. We do think there are some equity issues with the commercial and the owned units. I would thank you for allowing testimony today.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 322. And let's see. You're here on 2523, are you? Okay, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2523. Paul, are we going to be able to work any of these bills today? Okay, we have the paperwork? Okay, but let's do this hearing. Go ahead and explain the bill, and you're here to be heard on that bill, aren't you?
Pardon me?
Are you here to be heard on that bill?
Just here to answer any questions.
2523? Okay. Thanks. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2523 effectively transfers administration of the manufacturing portion of the Business Energy Tax Credit from the Oregon Department of Energy to the Oregon Business Development Department. The only addition to the only change in structure to the existing credit is that it expands upon rulemaking for Business Oregon with respect to standards related to job creations for certified projects. So it just tightens up some of the standards for the projects and allows the department to enter into performance agreements. You also have in front of you a dash A5, which just clarifies the sunset date for the tax credit. It's not a change from current law, it just clarifies that sunset date. The way 2523A reads is you have to put together a couple of pieces, a couple of different sections of the bill to get to the sunset date. With the language in the A5, it puts it in one place, and it's just crystal clear that it maintains the sunset date for preliminary certifications of January 1st, 2014. In order to use the credit, a project owner would have to have that pre-cert by January 1, 2014. Within the bill, just pointing out a couple of sections on how they piece together, Section 15 is the section that has the total cap for the bill. And it's a $200 million cap for the 9/11 and 11/13 biennium. And then there's a $50 million cap for the 6 months from July 1st, 2013 to December 31st, 2013. So that's the cap that's the largest amount of, that's the total amount of pre-certs that the department could issue. And the existing Section 3, the way it's drafted, refers to the final certification, which would be 5 years later. So it gets there, but the A5 just is clearer.
Okay. And we have the paperwork for the bill, but not the A5.
Correct. You have the paperwork for the 2523A.
Right.
So you could work that.
Right.
For the A5, we are in need of a fiscal statement.
Okay. All right. Gentlemen.
Co Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim McCabe, the director of the Oregon Business Development Department. The only thing I'd add to what Chris has said is we've been the department that's done the due diligence on every manufacturing BSE since the inception of the program. I was in the governor's office when the program started, and Peter Cogswell was the energy advisor at the time, and he and I agreed that at that time the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department should be the department that does the due diligence and screens the applicants, because that's what they did, and we continue to do that. So we've created a process. We use third-party verification for outside vendors that include Turner & Townsend out of Munich, Germany. They include Evergreen right here in Oregon, Evergreen Engineering in Eugene and Hillsboro, New Roots in Portland, Think Energy headquartered in Maryland, and Navigate Consulting. We put out RFPs. This department puts out the RFP to do the due diligence to screen the applicant's business plan, and we make the determination whether they should get the pre-cert or not, and advise the Department of Energy. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Just briefly, so one of the things this bill does is transfer the certification authority to the department and away from the Department of Energy. This bill does that, I assume.
Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Okay, great. Now, colleagues, this bill has already been extensively worked in the Transportation Economic Development Committee,
yes.
And the work group met and has continued to work on this bill. My suggestion, let's go ahead and finish the public hearing. And did you have some additional comments you wanted to make?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, no, I would just iterate the points that Chris made in terms of what the bill aims to do is tighten up the standards that are already in place and codifies the due diligence process that Director McCabe had mentioned with respect to the jobs and wages.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Let's hear from Jody Weiser. And is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2523?
Thank you. Can I ask a question, Representative Barnhart?
Please, while she's coming up. Sure.
Are you being punished?
I'm sorry?
Are you being punished? You look like you're on a stool or something. You're not on a chair.
Oh, you know, the judges' chairs that the legislature improvidently bought for our use do not fit me very well.
Oh.
And I end up with terrible backaches.
Okay.
The interesting thing is the side chairs, like the ones you're using, work very well.
Okay.
So I use those. Thank you for the question.
Just curious.
They didn't consult me when they bought chairs.
And obviously, these chairs must fit me pretty well, too, because I'm up here awfully often this year. For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So I was not party to any of the prior meetings about this bill. And so if I had been, perhaps I would understand the bill better than I do. But I'd like to walk through the AIM Gross version and raise with you some questions that I have in reading the bill. On page 3 of the bill, it begins to talk about the minimum level of employment provisions that are being added to the considerations when we extend tax credits of up to $20 million to a business. However, there's nothing in the language of the bills that tells how this requirement would interact with the basic idea, which is we provide up to 50% of the cost of a facility with a cap at $20 million. So how would it intersect? There's no direction from you saying we don't want to give more than $50,000 per job or anything that would give meaning to this provision. It's just kind of stuck in there. But there's no mechanism for how it interacts with a capital cost approach to subsidizing a business. And I think that
There are other places in the language of our bills that we say that we want something, but it actually doesn't get used because there's no mechanisms for using it. There's no mix between the two matrices. On the next page, at section 7, line 11, it talks about a manufacturing facility would receive no more than one tax credit in a year, one preliminary certification. And yet when you look at the spreadsheet that I've given you, Solar World has been approved for numerous tax credits in a single year. It appears to me that what's happening in manufacturing is the same thing that was happening on wind farms. They're being broken up into various units. And so, you know, we wanted a wind farm to get a certain amount, and they were actually, instead of getting $10 million, they were getting $30 million. And the same is happening with manufacturing. Solar World has been, has had three approvals for preliminary certifications in the year 2010, and they total almost $55 million. Particularly if you look at how does that fit with the job matrix, we are paying, in each of the cases I've looked at, we're paying at least $100,000 per job, and $100,000 is not recoverable. It would take more than 25, if every job paid $70,000 a year, and I doubt that the average is that high, we'd be collecting about $4,200 on each of those jobs. And if you do the math, it takes someplace over 25 years of collecting individuals' personal taxes to pay for the tax credit that we've provided to create those jobs. And while it's true that Solar Power and Solar World and Sanyo and everybody else will be making purchases in the local economy, that is also true of any teacher, social worker, home health care provider, or anyone else that we use these same dollars to keep employed. They all spend money in the local economy as well. The next thing I would raise is, you know, would seem to me that our solar cluster would be complete. When I last asked, when will we be done with solar, I was told when we got thin film. Well, we have thin film now. We've pre-certified Solar Power, and they're doing thin film, and yet we're continuing this tax credit at the same level of $20 million per facility, however many ways you break a facility up into numerous facilities. And it may be it's time to say, oh, we're not going to do 50% of the cost anymore. We're going to do 25% of the cost. We're not going to have a cap of $20 million. We're going to have a cap of $10 million. We could spread this money out and leave more money for the core purposes of our state if we weren't spending so much on each one of these projects. At the bottom of page 14, there's discussion of the director considering the status of a facility as a research, development, or demonstration facility. That's the only place in this bill that the RD&D tax credits are mentioned. And it's unclear to me, are we transferring manufacturing, or are we transferring both manufacturing and RD&D to Business Oregon? It seems to me that they fit together, but RD&D and manufacturing it's not clear that's what's happening in this bill. There's just this one mention in here, and obviously they talk to each other. Maybe we're leaving RD&D in the other building, but that's another $100 million that we've committed, and it seems like we should know where the management of that's going to be. On page 5, in the middle of the page on line 22, it says that we're asking that these facilities operate for 5 years, but we're giving them $20 million. We're not going to recover it in 5 years. I don't know how that number came to be. I suspect it's because we were giving 5-year tax credits. But it seems to me that when we are
paying up to 50% of the cost of a business building a manufacturing plant, we should be asking for 10 or 15 years, not 5 years of commitment to the state. And in the next line, two lines down, I wonder if we should ask for the full-time equivalent of jobs, not just jobs. I know that the application forms that people are filling out under the Betsy just say how many jobs you're providing. And if you're putting in a solar array on top of a school, you might hire 20 different people, but none of them may work for more than 20 hours. And so we really do need to know what the full-time equivalent jobs are, not just the number of jobs. And I think we should be sure that we segregate the construction jobs from the continuing jobs that are in the facility on a continuing basis afterwards, because there's a significant difference between those. On page 6, there's a formula for the discount that would be given if you sell your tax credits. And I think it would be interesting to know, because this is a different formula than we currently have, what would the rates be today under this formula? And so we could compare that to what the rates are if you try to go buy a 1 or a 5 year certificate of deposit. You know, what's the difference in that return on investment there? It seems to me that to date, all of the Betsy and Retsy tax credits that have been for all the Betsy tax credits that have been for sale have mostly been marketed to a very select group of people, those people with large tax liabilities. And so we have tended to have a rather generous rate. My accountant told me I'm earning 32% on my 5-year Betsy, 32% a year on my 5-year Betsy. That is extraordinarily generous. I think if we were selling these things to the public, like war bonds were sold during World War II, and like green energy is being sold by PGE today, we'd have people in this state who are happy to pay extra for their energy in order to be green. And I bet you we could get people to buy these tax credits at face value in order to be green if we gave them a sticker to put on their door to show that they're supporting what we're doing in this state. And so the discount that's in this bill, we don't even know what it means, what's written here. And I think it continues the idea of merchandising to the wealthy rather than to the public. And we could really change what we're doing by merchandising to the public instead. And then my final question is, there's talk about the conditions that must be met by the manufacturer in terms of jobs and pay. And I'm wondering if those conditions will be public information available on the public website for accountability, and have drafted some possible amendments to make sure that that would happen. I think that when we are giving away money in lots of 3 to 20 million, we should know exactly what we're getting for it instead of being told, well, these are high wage jobs. And that's about it. That's about all we know. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Jody? Thank you. All right. Well, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2523. Colleagues, I am told that we have the paperwork necessary to move at 2728. So let's open the work session on House Bill 2728. Is that yours too? You want to tell us a little bit about that one? And
sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2728. You first heard a couple weeks ago. You had the public hearing. It allows taxpayers to make the direct deposit contributions of personal income tax refunds into an Oregon 529 College Savings Network account. The bill provides that the election shall be made on a form prescribed by the Department of Revenue and may not be changed or revoked. It would apply to refunds attributable to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2012. The paperwork you have, the revenue impact is a minimal revenue loss of less than $50,000 a biennium and would just be from tax contributions that would be made this way that would not have been made otherwise. I assume most taxpayers would just transfer rather than writing the check. They might make use of this way of making contributions, so I wouldn't expect a significant change in that. You do have a fiscal impact statement that shows an other funds expense of about $64,000 in the 11-13 biennium, and that would be a transfer from the 529 account to the Department of Revenue in terms of setting up the process here.
Okay. Colleagues, this is one of those bills that, under the existing rules in the House, probably needs to go to Ways and Means. And the policy is simple, and I think the bill itself is pretty simple. I think the issue that concerns me about some of the other legislation that we've been talking about, that is that it needs to get a policy committee look at from the other side, maybe less important on this bill than on the others. And I'm concerned about whether we can get it through the process if we don't send it to Ways and Means today. And so my suggestion is that if it is the committee's pleasure to send the bill out with a due pass, that we also recommend that it should go to Ways and Means directly rather than waiting for the speakers to tell us it has to. What's your pleasure? Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I hope I have the phrasing correct. I move House Bill 2728 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Is that the right form? I think it is. All right. Representative Reed moves House Bill 2728 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request for a subsequent referral to the committee, Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? All right, motion carries. That was quick. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2728. We don't need a carrier if it goes to Ways and Means. If they turn us down, then we can appoint a carrier then.
Can we do that without recommendation to JTAC?
I suppose we could.
You have the paperwork for the A version.
Right.
That would be without the amendment.
Right.
You don't have to.
Well, let's do this first. We're going to carry over. Tomorrow we're meeting at 8:30. Is that right? We're going to hear, and so please be prompt. We're going to hear from the state economists about the revenue projections. We will have a little time after that, we hope, to do work, and we hope by that time to have the paperwork necessary on House Bill 2328. So we'll carry that over until tomorrow. And let's carry over also House Bill 2523 until tomorrow and see what your pleasure is on that tomorrow. And hopefully we'll be done with the report by 9:30. If we're ready, these other two can be managed very quickly, I think. And with that, having exhausted our agenda, committee's adjourned.